Okay, it's 9 o'clock. So although a number of people are still no doubt going to be logging on, we should start. Before we begin, I just want to take a few minutes to respond to some comments that were sent to me during the break and some other things that have been going on. First, if you recall last semester, we spoke about what happened in the Tel Yeshiva and the students, basically the uprising they had there. And so there were some comments made about how come we don't have that anymore. It turns out that the spirit of the yeshivas has not totally died, although for the most parts it's been, the old spirit has been put out, but some embers still remain. Because in the last week there's something amazing that occurred that really takes us back to the early part of the 20th century. The students at the Hebron Yeshiva went on strike against the administration. Now, what precipitated this strike? What precipitated it was two things. First of all, the yeshiva, the Hebron Yeshiva, I have an article here, and, you know, one of the students was being interviewed, how in the Hebron Yeshiva, unlike other yeshivas, there's always been a lot of liberalism. That is, the students can do what they want to do, and they're not really controlled. Now, the idea of the Purim Rav, we're in the Purim season, so it should be mentioned, is an old tradition that it's really hard to imagine how this is ever permissible. And Rav Avadi Yosef has a response saying it's absolutely forbidden to have a Purim Rav. What a Purim Rav is that one of the students, a comedian, will imitate the rabbi, either Rosh Yeshiva, another Rebbeim in the yeshiva, all in good fun, but it's mocking them in a fun way. Rav Gorin actually has a response saying that this, in his recent Shuvot, that this is the tradition, the Purim Rav, and you can't get rid of it. Now, Rav Gorin, the yeshiva, I mean, they pretty much, I thought they had already. If you're looking, by the way, if you're interested in following the news, you look at the Ner Yisrael Yeshiva. They appointed a Rosh Yeshiva about 10 years ago, and his whole goal is to turn the Ner Yisrael Yeshiva into a yeshiva just like Panavej and Mir, and it's creating enormous controversy among former students of the Ner Yisrael Yeshiva. But you have the same thing with the Hebron Yeshiva. Last year, they said that the Purim Rav could not make fun of the rabbis. He could only deal with the common, you know, issues of the yeshiva itself. And this year, they made the rule. There's this one rabbi in particular, Rav Yosef Charoni, who's in charge. He made the rule. I mean, he's not the head Rosh Yeshiva, but he's one of the people, important people in the yeshiva. He made the rule that there will be no Purim Rav at all. Even if, whether you speak about the rabbis or speak about the yeshiva, nothing. And if you want to know how ingrained this is, just go on YouTube and plug in Hebrew Purim Rav Rav Shach, and the first thing you'll get is a video from the Hebron Yeshiva 1990. In fact, you can also go to slabodka.org. This is a website, slabodka.org, put out by people from the Slabodka, you know, graduates of the Hebron Yeshiva, and you have there, the sound isn't so good, but you have there one of these comedians imitating Rav Shach, imitating the Rosh Yeshiva. So what happened when Hebron Yeshiva banned it? The students went crazy. They went, the Rosh Yeshiva, or not the Rosh Yeshiva, but this man in the administration hung up signs against it and all these things, and they ripped it down. It led to 8 students being expelled from the yeshiva, just like we had saw in the Hebron Yeshiva, in the Tel Yeshiva. And the students of the Hebron Yeshiva went on strike. I'm looking at the articles right here. The first Seder, that is the morning Seder, they refused to be part. They wouldn't go into the Beis Medrash. They went outside. They were dancing, doing all these things. And the Rosh Yeshiva had to bend. Just like we saw in Tells, because look, you could be a Rosh Yeshiva. If you're a Rosh Yeshiva, but you have no one in the Yeshiva, then you're not a Rosh Yeshiva. By definition, a Rosh Yeshiva has to have students. So if the students are all going on strike, and here I'm looking at an article. Rosh Yeshiva Hebron Nichne'u V'Hechsiru Et HaTalmidim HaMasulo Kingli Yeshiva. So what I'm seeing here is that the Rosh Yeshiva backed down. They have 2 demands. One of the demands was to have a Purim Rav ceremony again, and the other is to let the 8 students who were thrown out for being the troublemakers, and that's a very large yeshiva. We're talking about the Hebron and Givat Mordechai. They allowed the 8 students to come back in. Now, the Rosh Yeshiva met with the people who are leading these protests. However, what I haven't been able to see in the articles here is what's the story this year? No Purim Rav, and we'll see what happens again next year. I don't know the details, and I haven't been able to find it, but I do think it's significant to show you that, as I mentioned, that old spirit of rebellion, which was a Musar Yeshiva idea. This all comes out of the Musar Yeshivas. And the Chevron Yeshiva is the descendant of the premier Musar Yeshiva, the Sabotki Yeshiva. The fact that you still see the Bachrim, still, you would think with all these protests, these rallies and everything, that in the Haredi world, no one has a brain anymore. They just listen to whatever they tell them. But you still see that there are Yeshiva students who are willing to stand up for what they think is the tradition. And as I read you, and I'll just read you one more sentence that appeared this on the website, Kikar Shabbat, in which one of the students being interviewed says that this is the spirit of the Chevron Yeshiva and all its years of existence, and all the graduates will testify to it. And now we have a feeling that they're trying to, you know, change this without lelo hityatzut im haTalmudim, without consulting with the students. What do they need to consult with the students for? If you're the Rosh Yeshiva, you make decisions. The answer is, in a traditional Litvish Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva are only Rosh Yeshiva because the students let them be Rosh Yeshiva. And if the students don't like them, like in Volozhin, when the students didn't like Reb Chaim Berlin, they didn't think he was learning enough, and they went on strike, they had to throw him out. They had to throw Reb Chassman. They had to throw as Mashkiach. That's the way it worked in the Lithuanian yeshivas, and it still lives on a bit in Chevron. Two more minutes I have before I start. One of you, he's not listening live, but he listens on tape, Jonathan Rossman. A number of you were very interested in last semester. We spoke about the Orchos Orchos Chaim of the Rush, who says that you can learn during Chazaras HaShatz. The Talmud Chacham doesn't need to pay attention. You know, as long as there's a minyan, the Talmud Chacham can do whatever he wants. Which the Mishnah Berurah, as I mentioned, is ambiguous. The Mishnah Berurah seems to imply the same thing, but that's definitely not the standard approach. So he showed me. There's this book called Divrei Chaim, there's a Rabbi Ginsburg from either Long Island or Forest Hills, one of those places, Aryeh Ginsburg, and he recorded all these questions he asked the late Rabbi Sheinberg. And this is on page 44. And he asked him, is it permissible for a Magid Shiur, one who's going to give a Shiur, to, during Chazaras HaShatz, to be learning, to prepare? If you're Talmud Chacham, you can learn. But Rav Sheinberg, these are all questions he was asked, like, on the spot, without opening up books. He's just, giving his answer, al regel achas, as we say. But then Rav Sheinberg says, but, b'mkom tzorach gadol, if there's a necessity, yesh li smocha orchos chayim l'rasha hitir. You can rely on the orchos chayim of the rush, and someone who's preparing a shiur. The question was, if you're preparing a shiur, I don't know if... He says you can. Maybe if he would have asked him, can anyone learn? I don't know what the answer would have been. Now, Rabbi Ginsburg is not so happy with this answer. And in the note, he says it's true that we know that there are many great Talmidei Chachamim who do learn during Chazaras HaShatz. And all you have to do is be in a shul with Talmidei Chachamim, and you see they're all looking at Sfarim. And he says that Rabbi Kornglass, that's from Neir Yisrael, told me that the reason you're not supposed to look in a sefer is because then you won't pay attention to the brachas. But if you can pay attention to the brachas, the end brachas, then you're allowed to learn a sefer. And then he says, but if you, he says there are some people who have a hard time concentrating. They just can't sit there and focus on all the words. So for them, it's enough to learn, and then just pay attention to the brachas. But he says that if you're one of these people who can actually sit and focus and concentrate on the entire Chazaras HaShatz without your mind wandering, then you shouldn't learn. So I guess that depends on each person. Okay, I have other things, but I will get to them next week. But let's pick up where we were. We were talking, as we ended last time, about the Yalde Tehran. The children, the Polish children who came from Tehran to the land of Israel in 1943. They arrived in spring of 1943, more than 1,000. And the last thing we said was, we raised the question, was how were they then supposed to be absorbed? I said that there were family members who wanted to take them in, and but some of them were quite distant, and it wasn't so easily granted, but generally it was. And the main dispute was over the religious and the secular, over how the children should be educated. That is, they lived in, like, what do you call them, orphanages, boys' towns, things like that, the ones who didn't have parents. Now, the religious groups, and this included the Aguda and Chief Rabbi Herzog and others, demanded that every child who did not have a parent, that is, a child who had no parents, he was an orphan, and there was most of these kids were not orphans, said that they should be sent to religious schools. The secularists, not Zionists, the labor Zionists, their attitude was just the opposite, that they should, if they don't have parents, they should be sent to the majority school, which is the secular schools. There wasn't, and by the way, this became an international thing. Religious Jews from all over, from America and England, even though this is in the midst of wartime, they all got involved in protesting that, you know, this is a persecution, as it were, against, and it was against the religious. Unlike today, this so-called persecution, which really is not persecution, this would have been real persecution against, because they would have taken kids from religious homes, just like happened later with the Yemenite kids, and would have educated them in a non-Orthodox fashion. The compromise that was arrived at, and this strikes me as a fair compromise, was that children over 14 should choose their own schools. I don't know how they picked the number 14, but they figured that children over 14 and older, they get to choose their own school. So even if they came from a religious school, they could choose to go non-religious, or vice versa. And if the children are under 14 and you had kids, so you could have kids 7, 8 years old, if they had come from a religious family in Poland, then they would be sent to a religious school. Now, it wasn't so easy to determine sometimes when you deal with very small children, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, you know, if you ask a 5-year-old if you come from a religious family or not. So they asked them questions like, did the father, this was a standard question, did your father say Kiddush on Friday night? And, I mean, I don't know if in Poland, if you had non-religious who would, traditionalists would say Kiddush. Apparently not. They were more secular. But that was the compromise. If they determined that they said Kiddush or other things, then they would be sent to a religious school. Now, in the end, 50% were placed in religious homes. It wasn't just schools, by the way. Some went to homes as well. Older ones lived in like these boys' town things. Others went to orphanage. Others went were adopted. 50% went religious and 50% non-religious. And if you look in the Hebrew Wikipedia article, I found there's a very nice article. I don't know who puts these articles together with footnotes and everything. Yalde Tehran, you'll get the exact figures. Now the Haredim were the word Haredi is anachronistic, because if you go back to the 1940s, the word Haredi is not used like it's used today. Haredi was used for all, and it says in the masthead, it talks about, it uses the word Haredi. It's not just that the Haredim, what we call Haredim, were not called Haredim. You didn't have the phenomenon of Haredi Judaism like you have today. You had the small pockets, but you certainly didn't have a mass appeal. You couldn't get hundreds of thousands of people on the streets, and the ideology was completely different. And by the way, scholars are going to be very busy in our lifetimes examining the changes, the real changes. An article just appeared arguing that Haredi Judaism is actually, it's a new form of Judaism. It's unlike anything we've ever seen before. That the focus is not on, if you look in classic texts about the job of the Jew in the world, the way he's supposed to influence not just the world, but influence non-religious Jews and all this, and that all this has been thrown out the window when we have a completely new form of Judaism that has arisen in the last 20 years before our eyes. I think that's probably overstating the case a bit, but there's no question that the Haredi Judaism we see today is unlike anything that we've ever had in history for a variety of reasons. We've talked about it a number of times. But so when I say Haredi, talk about the Haredim in the 40s, I'm speaking about in the Aguda circles, yeshiva circles. Remember, in those days, everyone was working. I mean, the Aguda in the land of Israel was full of was Hasidim who had come early before the war. Those people all worked. There wasn't this ideal of just going to yeshiva, but it's out of these groups that we get the Haredi movement to a certain extent. So, the maybe not say Haredim, say the Aguda elements, they were still upset because they said that still some of the religious children were placed with non-religious institutions, and also, and this is not something new, this is talking in the 40s now, some of the Agudistan said that children who came from Agudistan families were placed in Mizrahi institutions. Now, if you know how opposed Aguda was to religious Zionism then as is now, although it's not as bad, obviously, to be placed in a Mizrahi institution as it is to be placed in a secular institution, it still was pretty bad. If you're an Agudistan and you're anti-Mizrahi, to say that children were placed with Mizrahi, especially since there was the political battles between the two groups. If there weren't political battles, it wouldn't be so terrible. But population of each group determined, voting and things like that, even in the pre-state era. Now, Rabbi Reuven Katz, recognizing the problems, founded this yeshiva that I mentioned, Yeshivas Nachas Reuven, and that was for these boys, those boys who came from religious families and who wanted to learn. And it became like a boys' town Torah. He was also able to use his office as chief rabbi at Petach Tikva to get certificates of aliyah for yeshiva students. This is before the war. Older kids, many of whom would study at the Lumja yeshiva we spoke about last week. And among those he was able to bring over, I mentioned, I think, last week, Shmuel Rozovsky, who becomes important at the Chevron yeshiva. Also another important Chevron, Ponov yeshiva, from David Povarsky. Both these names are very important. Shmuel Rozovsky, by the way, ends up becoming the son-in-law of Ritzi Pesach Frank. Now, during this time, before the war, let's go back to the war. It's the same thing during the war as well. When I just said that Reuven Katz used his office to get an Aliyah certificate. Why did you need an Aliyah certificate? Because the British had put forth a white paper, and Aliyah was severely restricted. They didn't want to mess up their relations with the Arabs. They recognized that oil was going to be very important. So there was very limited amounts given to the different groups, the labor Zionists, the chief rabbi, different people. Now, Rabbi Katz writes an article. His essays were collected later in this volume, Shar Reuven, which is historically significant because he was one of the important rabbis of the day. You had Rav Kook, and then later you had Rav Herzog. And of the communal rabbis after Rav Herzog, Rav Herzog, in addition to being, he was the chief rabbi, obviously, of the State of Israel and also recognized in Jerusalem. You had Ritzi Pesach Frank. Ritzi Pesach Frank was not a communal rav. He was an Av Beis Din. Rav Herzog sort of functioned as a communal rav in Jerusalem. And the next, and then you had Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv, you had important communal rav, you had Rav Amiel. And after that, I would say that Rav Reuven Katz was the most important of the communal rabbis in Petach Tikva. I mean, Haifa's, even those days, would have been bigger than Petach Tikva, but Petach Tikva is a more significant city historically, and Rav Reuven Katz was already regarded as an elder Talmud Chacham in the 1940s. So I would say he's the third most important rabbinic position, and he's speak as communal rav, and he's speaking on issues of the day. And many of them were collected here, and listen to what he writes. This comes, if you want to check it, in Shar Reuven, and it was published in 1952. But on pages 20 and 21, this is an article from 1939, June of 39. He writes about how terrible it is that we trusted Great Britain, that Britain would help us build our national home, which the meaning of it was that Eretz Yisrael belongs to the land, the people of Israel. And then he says, based on this emunah, we fought on the side of Great Britain in the First War. And we, there was a, he's referring to the fact that in World War I, you had people, Zionists, who, joined the British Army because they knew that, the British Army, if once they pushed out the Ottoman Empire, you'd have a chance for a Jewish homeland. And he says that, so we fought for them and we lost. We sacrificed, our choice sons. Many of our young people fell in order that Britain be victorious. And he's probably including in there also Jews who lived in England and just fought for the British, which I don't know. They weren't fighting for the land of Israel, be that as it may. And then he says, with Jewish influence, America came to the defense of Britain. Again, I don't know historically how you could say America is Jews influenced America to go to defend Britain, but that's what he's saying. And he says, and therefore, because of this Jewish influence, Germany is defeated. And then he goes on to say that we also gave money, million lirot, and we turned this land into, from a desolate desert into a great, fruitful field. And he says, and now comes Britain and is treacherous. Bagdabanu. At the time when we have no place else to go, he's referring to the refugees, the only place is the land of Israel. At the time that people are literally starving and we're being, he says, we're being persecuted. And, near Dafim, he's not saying killed, this is 39, but persecuted in the diaspora. Jewish refugees are going left and right. They're on the waters with no place to go. And he said that this moment, this important moment, what does Britain want to do? It wants to hand over the land of Israel to a group of murderers for its own purposes. And very, very strong words. And then he concludes, the land of Israel is not given to anyone. It's not given to Britain. The whole, who's it given to? It's given only to God. That's who it belongs to, and God gives it to the Jews. So we see his attitude. So there were people who decided to take matters into their own hands before the war, but during the war, you had the Irgun and Lechi, and who did participate in terrorist activities. And the Irgun, during the war, members went up to Beirut to meet with the German ambassador there, and they said that as long as Germany stops the anti-Semitism, they will join together with Germany. They will open up a new front, on Germany's side in the land of Israel. But the Irgun stopped all attacks, but then they picked up again after the war was over, and Menachem Begin, of course, was the leader of the Irgun. You've all been to Israel, you've all seen the King David Hotel and other things. It's a difficult problem, the Irgun. On the one hand, they're heroes, and in fact, my last trip to Israel last summer, I went, it's the first time I've been since I was a kid, to the prison in Akko, and you go in the rooms and you see where the Jews were hung, and there's also a prison in Jerusalem where you can go see the Akko is from the story Exodus, that's famous, but you have a prison in Jerusalem as well where Baryu Levine used to go to these prisoners, and these are heroes, no question about it. On the other hand, there's also no question about it that while some of them were being even executed for crimes such as they were caught holding with arms, which is a capital offense, others were involved in robberies. They robbed banks, for instance, and others killed British soldiers, and not just British soldiers, civilians, British civilians who are working for the government, and also Arab civilians. So it's a difficult problem. What does Jewish law say about this? The rabbis, as far as I know, the rabbis unanimously were opposed to these actions. And I'll read you what Rabbi Reuven says in a minute. And today there's no question that this would be regarded as terrorism and it wouldn't be acceptable. The Irgun, in response to Arab terrorism, car bomb blew up in front of the Jewish agency. Car bombs blew up they had car bombs blowing up. There was all sorts of terrorism. But the Irgun and Lechi also involved themselves in terrorism with the same measure. They had bombs blowing up in civilian neighborhoods. They threw grenades into crowds of Arabs. The sort of thing that today we would say is terrorism, but by the same token, World War II was fought. American planes, British planes bombed civilian centers. That's how the war was fought, to break the back of the civilians. So we dropped two atom bombs on cities. We bombed Dresden and we bombed cities. We bombed civilians. Now today we would never have bombings like that. It would be regarded as violations of the rules of war. So I'm just saying that because if you want to justify the acts of the Irgun, you can simply say that warfare was fought differently in those days. Just like you bombed from the air on civilians, you threw hand grenades into civilians. But the Irgun went further. They would hold them captive. If a Jewish person who's scheduled to be executed is hung, we will hang this British soldier. Now, they always said, we don't want to do that, so we're just responding. And the British did not give in to this blackmail, and they would execute the Jewish prisoners, and the British soldiers would be executed. And I'm not just referring to things like the bombing of the King David Hotel, but incidentally, which a warning was sent. I remember years ago, I went through the Jewish Chronicle looking for other things, and during the war, there was all sorts of, during the 46 and 47, there was all sorts of anti-Semitic incidents against Jews in Britain, because the British Jews were seen as, somehow complicit to what was going on in the land of Israel, and these were British soldiers being killed. After Begin becomes prime minister, there were all these veterans who served in Palestine, who said that Britain should not allow him into, the country, and if he does come in, he has to be arrested as a war criminal. Menachem Begin was the most wanted man in Palestine. He went undercover. He lived as what they called the Sassover Rebbe. He grew a beard and looked like a Hasidic Rebbe, and only a few people knew who he was. It was the biggest secret, and I said he was the man most wanted after the destruction of the King David Hotel. And you can read all about it in his book, The Revolt. So what does Rav Reuven say? Very interesting. This is from an essay that appears in Cheshvan. So we're talking October, let's say, of 1946, where really the battle between Lehi, the Stern Group, the Irgun, and the British was going strong. The Haganah, they have an interesting role in it themselves, because the Haganah, they thought that these actions were counterproductive, and there was a time where the Haganah participated, they called it the season, the Saison, in which the Haganah actually hunted down members of the underground, Irgun and Lehi. They never, as far as I know, when this was confirmed by someone in my town who has done a lot of research on it, as far as he knows, they never turned over a member of the Irgun or Lehi to the British. However, they did capture them, and they did they whipped them. They did all sorts of things. But as far as I know, they never actually became collaborators in the sense that they turned one over. And there was always conflicts between the Haganah, which is the mainstream organization, and Irgun or Lehi. So Rabbi Katz has an essay beginning on page 24 called B'Darchei Tohar. Pure or appropriate methods. And he talks about the terrible is great. That the fact that they have not allowed, not just before the war, after the war, when the Jews had been decimated, they still weren't let them into the land of Israel. You had all this illegal, I put illegal in quotation marks, aliyah. And also, I went to the Haifa, the Naval Museum last summer in Haifa, and you have an actual ship that was used to part of the museum is in a ship that broke the blockade, but they would send them to Cyprus and Eritrea. And these are people who had nowhere to go. They'd send them, for the most part, they didn't send them back to, as far as I know, they didn't send them back to Europe, but they put them in these refugee camps. So he says that, they have terrible guilt. But then he goes on and says, Ulam, he says, nevertheless, their guilt and their sin, lo chayvum b'mita. They're not worthy of the death penalty for this. And then he says, it appears to me that there is no justification to kill people who are innocent of any sin or crime just for political reasons, because they, shelohim adonim, they are not responsible for the politics. And they have not established it. They are not, if Anthony Eden, the British government, wants to pass a rule that, Jews are not allowed in the land of Israel, and that those Jews who are, carrying guns have to be arrested, and, ships need to be stopped. These people are just following orders, and they're not responsible for these laws. Obviously, we're not dealing with Nazi-type laws that you can say, just use the following orders excuse. Rav Katz says explicitly, they're not chayav misa. They're just doing what other people have told them to do. And he goes on. Even England, he says, is not so weak. Even after this war, England is not so weak that we can fight against England militarily. It still has strength. And Asur Lanu Ristakein B'Masim, we cannot, it's forbidden for us to put ourselves in danger by doing these actions that will cause us, he uses the words that Jacob uses after Shimon and Levi kill Shechem and all those guys. He says, you can't make us ground it. So, first of all, he's saying the action itself is wrong. You can't take life for political reasons, you know, because you want a state. Second of all, he's saying it's going to backfire. First of all, he can't defeat them militarily, and it's going to make us look terrible. I know that Rabbi Weinberg, Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, also was very opposed to the actions of the Irgun. And what he said was, I heard this from one of his students. He said this in 46 or 47. He said, England is a civilized country. We can't deal with England by planting bombs and killing soldiers. That's not how you deal with a civilized country. People in Eretz Yisrael, not all of them thought England was so civilized, if they're not letting the Jews in. But from my Weinberg's perspective, England had just fought a war, had just been part of the, you know, group that defeated the Nazis, and therefore the Jews cannot now turn around, even for the land of Israel, cannot turn around and start killing British soldiers. That was Rabbi Weinberg's position. He goes on, Rabbi Katz, he says, I call to you, Achen ani kore alechem, se'irim toim, misguided youth. That's what he refers to the Irgun. You know, depart from this bad path of yours and live. You know, live a life of peace. And Tikva Tova, he says, we believe that God will, you know, put his spirit upon the nations. Basically, that in the end, this is going, it wasn't going to be that much longer after that, that the land will be ours. There's no need for you to put yourself in danger, to maybe have yourself killed, to fight this war. This is not the approach. He says, be strong about for the tasks which are upon us. He says, approach this, bedarche shalom, v'shalva, v'toar, v'lo bedarche dami. Our method, our way, the Jewish way, is not to go with darche dami, with violence. Rather, we go darche shalom, we go in peace. And because the way of blood, he says, just brings to, as he said, what Jacob's old fear, that the nations are going to turn against us. And as I said, this was the approach. This was the approach of Rabbi Herzog. This was the approach of all the level-headed people, I think you can say. In retrospect, though, I believe most people do think that the actions of the Irgun lead to the British exit earlier than it would have. Look, they would have left. All the colonies were given over by the 1960s. There's no doubt that by 1960, Britain would not be in the land of Israel, but would have left in 48. I mean, it left India. You know, the nonstop, the terrorism and the difficulties did make it, you know, more appealing for them to wash their hands of it. But again, from Rabbi Katz's position, it's not justified. It's not justified to kidnap a British soldier, and if his government decides to execute a Jew, you kill this guy who himself is just a representative of this government but has no blood on his hands. And, I mean, it's harsh words to be using it. This is murder. I'm not going to go back in time and judge. I'm just saying that this is, the rabbis did believe that this was murder that the Irgun and the Lehi were involved in, and there were exceptions. Rabbi Yehuda Lev Maimon, who was a very important Mizrahi figure, he did support, not openly, obviously, but he was a supporter, they say, of the Irgun, and again, no one's judging in those days. You can understand how angry the Jews were that the British were not letting survivors into the country, but that's what Rabbi Katz writes. Now, the state is declared, as he expects, in 1948. There were some people in the religious world who thought it's the first time in over 2,000 years that Jews are really in control of their destiny. Because even though this, you know, the Second Commonwealth, as they say, is destroyed in finally the year 70, it's really not Masada, lasts a couple more years, but Jews had not been running the show than it was under Roman times. And if you think about it, even during the so-called monarchy of the Hasmoneans, they were not running the show. They were really puppets of an overlord. You might really have to go back to Bai Rishon, to the first temple, where you can speak about Jews really independent. So here we have the creation of a state. A lot of talk about bringing back a Sanhedrin. Why? Why do people want to bring back a Sanhedrin? And this is why it's always been more appealing for, you could say, the more liberal Orthodox or more the modern Orthodox, that there are things that just seem out of whack. Because here we have a modern state in modern times, and there are certain laws that were formulated in a completely different era where Jews were a minority, an oppressed minority, living under the rule of non-Jews. And there are certain changes that have happened. And not just within that aspect. I mean, one we spoke about when we dealt with Morocco, with Rabbi Messas, is with, for example, inheritance. Today, when young women are, even then, when women are getting married in their 20s, it's not like they're getting married off at 12 or 13, Sanhedrin. And some people thought that maybe today Yom Tov Sheni really doesn't have much use. Why do we need a Yom Tov Sheni Shel Goliot? We have calendars. Until then, it couldn't be changed. You didn't have a Sanhedrin. That's always been the problem, that we don't have the mechanism to update Jewish law. In the days of the Sanhedrin, if there would be a change in circumstances, Chazal had the authority to update it. We don't have that authority. So now that we're returning to the land of Israel, and we want to create sort of like a living law, like the way it used to be in the days of Chazal, we need a Sanhedrin. The great fear more from the more right wing is, though, what's this going to lead to? Are we going to start, you know, updating Jewish law with every fad under the sun? Today we would say, you know, with feminism, with progressive ideas, all these sorts of things. So there was a great divide, and Rabbi Maimon, who I just mentioned, was the big backer of a Sanhedrin. He wrote a book on it. Rabbi Herzog, Rav Kook, by the way, also held out this vision that when the state is declared, there will be a Sanhedrin. Rav Herzog was very afraid of making waves with the Charedim, and he was opposed to it. And Rav Reuven Katz was also opposed to it. In fact, in 1935 already, he writes to an author. There was an author who wrote a sefer talking about bringing back the Sanhedrin, and he wrote to him against this. By the way, let me just mention that, you know, since the Sanhedrin, the talk of the Sanhedrin in the late 40s and early 50s, when it was finally rejected by Rabbi Herzog in the religious Zionist world, no one ever heard about a Sanhedrin. And it wasn't even a pipe dream. It was a messianic dream. And then all of a sudden, about 7-8 years ago, you start hearing about this Sanhedrin. And at first I'm thinking that this is just a bunch of clowns. You know, unfortunately, we have in the land of Israel a bunch of, lots of clowns we know, including learned clowns, but just nobodies. And lo and behold, who's a member of this Sanhedrin? Rabbi Steinsaltz. So as soon as Rabbi Steinsaltz is on the Sanhedrin, you have to take it seriously. Although I'm not sure exactly what he saw. And then there was this Rabbi Yoel Schwartz, who's involved in, he's written many Sfarim with Yeshiva Devar Yerushalayim. So you had serious people on this Sanhedrin, who, by the way, made declarations which were not so serious, such as we have to, you know, they want to do the Karban Pesach and all these sorts of things. But as soon as Rabbi Steinsaltz, who was a very serious person, was involved in this Sanhedrin, I said, you have to take another look at what they're trying to do. But Rav Reuven writes to him and says that, first of all, this was already tried. It was tried in the days of Rav Jacob Beirav and Rav Levi Ibn Habib. They wanted to bring back a smicha, and that would be obviously, could be a precursor to the Sanhedrin, the authority of this. And if there was such a dispute a few hundred years before then, by the way, Yosef Karo, Maran, Yosef Karo, the author of Shulchan Aruch, is one of the people who really settle it today. So there's a technical matter here that we can't decide these problems. And he also says something else, which is quite interesting. Let me read it to you. He says, I recall, this is like a public protocol he wrote, he says, but it's addressed to, I mean, it was made public, but it's addressed to Rabbi Tzvi Makovsky. Well, he gives them all the titles. So he was on the base of Tel Aviv. So he's an important Talmud Chacham in the land of Israel. Rabbi Katz says that I remember when I was in Chutz Laaretz, we tried very hard, he was involved with this, to create a worldwide Agudas Rabbani, organization of rabbis. Who would it encompass? The rabbis of Poland, Lithuania, and America. That's we're talking the 20s, let's say. That's where the most rabbis were. And what was our reason, he says? That with God's will, every country, every land, we'd create a local Buddhist rabbanim, and then we'd have conventions of all the rabbis, and these would meet in the land of Israel. We'd all come together, and then later, when I came to the land of Israel for half a year, we tried to do the same thing and to call a gathering of rabbis from all over the world. And what were we going to do with that? And he says, and we even set a date. And then it was pushed off to be after Pesach. And then we were going to make a whole Agudas Rabbanim, and Eretz Yisrael would be the merkaz, the center. And what would it be? It would be the center of Torah Judaism in the world. So he says, that's the most we were interested in doing. But we weren't going to bring back Sanhedrin, which would have Smicha, etc. So why didn't this happen? Let me tell you first, who was involved with this effort in the land of Israel? Now, we're talking about when Rabbi Reuven, it didn't work when he was in Chutz Haaretz, so he picked up on it when he came to the land of Israel. There was an earlier attempt in the early 20th century, and a whole volume was published on this. It was organized by the Rabbi of Cairo, the Ashkenazic Rabbi of Cairo, Aaron Cohen. He published a whole huge sefer, also about bringing back a Sanhedrin, and as a precursor, he wanted to create an Agudas Rabbanim, an organization of rabbis, all over the world, and he had all sorts of rabbis who joined in, but nothing came of it. So listen to some of the names of the rabbis who supported this world organization of rabbis. And it's not just that, it's that they would, they then would appoint, the plan was to appoint among this, from this organization, the greatest Torah scholars. There'd be like a committee, and all Sanhedrin do. So if you have these four or five great Gedolim, it's sort of, I would say it's like the Moetzes Gedolia Torah of Agudas Yisrael, which is exactly what it would be, but the Moetzes Gedolia Torah is political. And this is more of a, it's just halachic. And since I mentioned the Moetzes Gedolia Torah and all this, I have to tell you something which I've been seeing in the news recently, and I asked a number of Haredi friends, and it's a very interesting phenomenon. You have this great dispute between Rabbi Auerbach, Shmuel Auerbach, and Rabbi Steinman. Rabbi Steinman really doesn't get involved with it. It's his underlings and also Chaim Kanievsky. But everyone in the Haredi world I've spoken to, without question, they all state that Rabbi Auerbach is a much bigger Talmud Chacham, a much bigger Lamdan than Rabbi Steinman. Not only do they say this, I'm not going to publish this, but everyone tells me the same thing, that Rabbi Steinman is not respected in the yeshiva world as a Lamdan Bichal at all. He's a Talmud Chacham, of course, but he's not considered one of the greatest Torah scholars. He never had a reputation as a great Talmudist. His Sfarim are not taken as seriously as high-level Sfarim. And yet, he has been crowned the Das Torah, which is very interesting because it's similar like in the Hasidic world, as we've spoken about. In the Hasidic world, the greatest Talmud Chacham is not the leader. Here we have a new thing here that in the Lithuanian world, at least one part of it, the greatest leader is not regarded as the greatest Torah scholar. How he became the greatest leader, you know, Rav Shach basically was the one who had confidence that he had the Das Torah, Rabbi Steinman, because he was with the Chazon Ish and everything. So you could have, as they've said it already, the supporters of Rabbi Steinman, just because you have a lot of Torah knowledge doesn't mean you have Das Torah. In other words, they're saying about Rabbi Auerbach, just because you're a great Torah scholar doesn't mean you have Das Torah. And it's nice for once that the right wing Lithuanian world is getting that, because the modern Orthodox world always got it. I mean, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he could be the greatest Talmud Chacham, but since he didn't follow their approach, he doesn't have Das Torah. I just got a sefer, which I can send to any of you. It's not really a sefer, it's more like a kuntres, put out by the opponents of Rabbi Steinman in Rabbi Auerbach's camp. And they pick up on this very issue that, you know, who's the real Lamdan here? And it's a whole book. It's a mocking book. It's made to look like it's a book of teachings of Rabbi Steinman. You know, they gather in different categories, just like they do with all these great rabbis, what he says on this and on that. And the whole point of it is to mock him. And yet, from my perspective, some of these things that they're quoting there to mock him make so much sense. He's quoted in there, for example, as saying that at some time, that today, there's something even more important than Torah. There's so many non-religious, we have such a great chance. Kiruv is even more important than learning Torah. So for some people, it's time to go out and do Kiruv and putting away their Sfarim. And that, to me, first of all, that became the standard Haredi view today, as we know. But some of these things they're quoting him as saying, as be, to make fun of him and to say that this shows he doesn't have Das Torah, most people reading it would, here's a great one. They come to him, a student, he died young at one of the yeshivas. So they came to Rabbi Steinman and they wanted to know, what should we do? Should we, you know, do fast days? You know, what, you know, what should we do, you know, to take upon ourselves for this terrible tragedy? And Rabbi Steinman said, and these all come, by the way, from books put out by Rabbi Steinman's people that they're using it. Rabbi Steinman's response is, unfortunately, tragedies happen. In other words, he's saying to him, it's terrible that the Yeshiva Bachar died, but just because he died doesn't mean all of a sudden we have to now start doing Tehillim and doing these things. These things happen. It's life. And, you know, life is tragedy. There's bad things that happen. So that seems to me to be a very refreshing way of looking. And not everything that happens means that we got to turn our life upside down and, you know, doing all these, you know, gatherings to prayers and Tehillim. You know, sometimes bad things just happen. We can't understand it. But our job is just to go on, and with our Torah lifestyle, they quote this as an example of Rabbi Steinman doesn't appreciate, you know, the job of a manhig, the leader. And I think it's just the opposite. Now, Bill says, let me just take Bill's question, and I want to read you some of these names. In the issue of Torah to go in honor of Smicha, well, you, there was a good summary, Jacob has this thing, Rabbi Rav. Oh, yes, okay. I saw that, Bill. I'm not going to say I was reading during Chazar Sashatz because I wasn't, but I will admit, during Kriyas Torah, I was reading, what am I supposed to do? They put these things out. So I grabbed the new YU to go, and Rabbi David Horowitz, who's one of the most, I think, thoughtful and learned, and who has the most to offer of the younger Rosh Yeshiva, he has an essay in there on the reviving the Smichat controversy between Yaakov Eirav, and it's a good summary, and the Ralbach, Lady Ibn Chabib. For those who don't know, Rabbi David Horowitz harkens back to an older model. He actually has a PhD. So is Rabbi Rosenzweig, but his PhD is on, it's on the Ralbach. If you listen, we're on Torah in Motion now. You can download some of his talks on Rav Kook and other things. And, I don't know why, he's not better known. And, if I was at YU, I'd be, you know, he's a real model of Torah Mada, Torah in Derech Eretz with real deep knowledge of the medieval Jewish philosophical tradition. Rabbi Bleich would be the only comparable one, I think, in YU. And Rabbi Horowitz focused on the Ralbach. Okay, but let me read you now some of the names of people who agreed to be part of this World Rabbinic Council. And when pay attention to the names, because you'll see what happens in the end, that why it doesn't come. First, you have Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer. Who's greater than Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer? Rabbi Yaakov Meir, Sephardic Chief Rabbi. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. Rabbi Hillman, that's Rav Herzog's father, Rav Tukachinsky, Rav Zevin, Rav Amiel, Rav Uziel, Rav Kalmas, Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher. And who in Chutzaretz supported them? This is from right before the war. Rav Herzog. Actually, this is from 1934, I think, because he's still in Ireland. Rav Tzirelson of Romania. The Kovno Rav, Rav Shapiro. Rav Menachem Zemba. Rav Leventhal of Philadelphia. Listen to those names. You would think with all these names in support of creating a worldwide organization of rabbis. And what could be wrong with a worldwide organization of rabbis? Don't we have the RCA? Isn't that a worldwide organization? Don't we have the Agudas Rabbanim? Don't we have all these things? What could possibly be the problem with it? And that's what they thought. And all these rabbis wrote letters in support of it. How great it would be. What happens, though? So they wanted the name, I mentioned Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, they wanted to call it the Moetzes Gedolei HaHorah. That all the big problems, so if you have an issue, electricity or something like that, I don't know, by the way, if this is the traditional Jewish approach. I mean, when in history do we, other than in the Sanhedrin, do we have this? So where you bring it to a committee of rabbis, but that was the plan. To do it. The only other example I really know of is the RCA had a halacha commission where difficult questions would be brought to the RCA. It doesn't exist anymore. But it really wasn't a halacha commission because Rabbi Soloveitchik was on it. So yes, he had other rabbis who were on it, young rabbis, Rabbi Parnas, for example. Young Rabbi Parnas was on the commission. But if Rabbi Soloveitchik decides this is what the halacha should be. You think these other rabbis are going to protest and go against him? So I don't know really how traditional this is, but if you are hearkening back to a Sanhedrin model, well, that's what you do. However, Rav Chaim Ozer, this shows you his towering significance. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski came out against all these other rabbis and opposed this. Why? He said, and I'll read you some of what he wrote in a minute, but just he said that experience has shown how these organizations run, and everyone should pay attention to this because what's going on in Israel now, you can learn a lot. I mentioned, despite people like Rabbi Steinman, that it's the so-called Askanim who are creating these new forms and declarations they're making about the only things that are important in life, totally at odds for Jewish tradition. A lot of them are not coming from the leadership. They're coming from, we call them the Askanim. And we know that these so-called Askanim, busybodies or these activists, whatever you want to call them, they don't take orders often from the higher-ups. It's a dialectic. You know, they influence the higher-ups as much as the higher-ups decide. And I've said it already. If Rabbi Steinman tomorrow, or Yashav would have come out and said, if Rabbi Steinman tomorrow comes out and says, you know, I really think we should only allow 5,000 to go to yeshiva full-time, let the rest go to the army. You think Rabbi Steinman's still going to be their god? Oh, of course not. They'll kick him out. Just like if he decides tomorrow to say, Hagel on Yom HaTzmaut, they'd throw him out. So that would be the end of his Das Torah. So he only has Das Torah if they let him have it. But Rabbi Steinman actually asked that the leaders of the religious Zionist world who supported the protest rally in Jerusalem last week, and there were some, the Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz HaRav, Rav Yaakov Shapiro, Rav Shmuel Eliyahu of Tzfat, he was one of them. Rabbi Steinman asked that they be put, you know, on the dais, that never happened. The Askanim didn't want to, because they want to keep far away, for their own political reasons, far away from the religious Zionist groups. And if you know some of the statements that have come out recently, one of the leaders of the Shas party referred to religious Zionist rabbis as behemot. This rabbi Mutsafi, who's another leading Sephardic rabbi, referred to Rav Avinair as a Russia. I mean, the language they're using is also like language we've never heard before. I mean, I can't, in my lifetime, or even in the studies, when has rabbis ever spoken to rabbis like that? And it's ironic. You have to give credit where credit is due. One of the extremist Haredi rabbis, one of Rabbi Auerbach's followers, Rabbi Zicherman, he attacked the Yated Ne'eman because the Yated Ne'eman refuses now to give Rabbi Druckmann the title rabbi. You know, he doesn't agree with them, so they took away the title rabbi, and Rabbi Zicherman says, and when did we ever hear that you removed the title rabbi? Fine, you have a dispute. But for newspapers, not Talmidei Chachamim, to remove the title of rabbi? In any event, why is this all relevant? Because Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grudzinski says, and we're talking 80 years ago, he says experience has shown that in rabbinic organizations, he's talking about the Agudas Rabbanim of Poland, which included Vilna, that was part of Poland, that the decisions are not made by the Gedolim. The decisions are made by the Askanim. I have it, I don't want to get up and get it for you, but I've quoted it before. It's by this Israeli Haredi, but his name escapes me now. He's written a few books, Mihei Arad Katowice is one of them, in which he shows that from the beginning of Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel, that decisions have been made often at odds with what the great rabbis have wanted. So Rav Chaim Ozer doesn't say that himself. Quotes the Chafetz Chaim as agreeing that these rabbinic organizations are dangerous because in the end, who's going to be making decisions? It's not the Gadol. The Gadol is busy learning. In other words, the great rabbi doesn't know about the politics. The great rabbi is learning. How does the great rabbi know about what's going on? Because of his associates tell him. And therefore, at the end of the day, the great rabbi's decision is really based upon what the associates tell him. So who's making the decision? The associates are the ones determining what the great rabbi is going to decide, because they can play the issue however they want. So Rav Chaim Ozer says, therefore, we can't have an organization like this. Rabbis need to remain independent on their own, making their own decisions. My only response to Rav Chaim Ozer would be, maybe he didn't have this in his day, but we have it today without question, is that, fine, Rav Chaim Ozer was worried you're going to have an organization with an office and employees, and therefore who's going to make the decisions? the employees, not the rabbis. Today we have rabbis. They're individual rabbis, like Rav Chaim Moser wanted, and we still have decisions being made for them, but we never had years ago. Think of Rav Moshe Feinstein. To speak to Rav Moshe Feinstein, did you have to go through 10 different, you need a protexia, and you have to go to 10 different people? His phone number was in the phone book. Anyone could go up and talk to him. Today, to get him to speak to these rabbis, you have to go through various gatekeepers. Do Rav Moshe Feinstein have 10 people, an army of him, telling him what to do, this and that? Did any of our great rabbis have that? So we have a completely new phenomenon that what Rav Chaim Ozer Ruzinski said was the danger of rabbinic organizations. We see this today in our own lifetime with individual rabbis who are literally have cabinets in which decisions are made sort of like in a cabinet. It's exactly what Rav Chaim Ozer said is dangerous, that the pekid, the employee, the helper, he's going to end up making all the decisions. Oh, it's already 10. When, next class, I will read you some of the language, because this then becomes the Haredi Das Torah. Because of this, and we'll see where Reuven Katz, he goes along with this, rabbinic organizations become treif. And no one talks about them. There's not an internet, if not the letter, of what Chaim Ozer is saying. And it wasn't until Rav Gorin comes in that he once again floats the idea of a world rabbinic organization. If you look at the letters of Rav Shach, he attacks this by quoting Rav Chaim Ozer, that we already know what these rabbinic organizations will do. Let me, we've covered a lot, and still good stuff coming. Let me end here and take the question. The Askanim Yisrael says middle management. Okay, let me look back at the questions. Handlers, that's the best word, handlers, exactly. There's a rabbi, Rosen, he's a bit of a, I guess you'd say left-wing Orthodox rabbi in New York. It's a family of three brothers. One of them was the Yakar Minyan, and there's one in New York, Jeremy Rosen. But he wrote a very interesting essay. He went, his Rosh Yeshiva was it Rav Moshe Shmuel Shapiro, I think it was? I forget who it was. But he writes about how when he was young, and he was in Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva was so approachable. And that's what he remembered. And then he hadn't seen his Rosh Yeshiva in like 25 years, and he sees him, I think it was an Eretz Yisrael, and all of a sudden he's surrounded by all these handlers, and he says it was a completely different persona. It wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva he knew. It was like a, you know, you all know what I'm talking about. And he was reflecting in this essay, I could find it if anyone's interested, he's reflecting on how sad it was, how it changed, the simplicity, which is piety. You know, the simplicity of the great Rosh Yeshiva was not there anymore. Instead, you had the handlers and the gatekeepers. Shlomo says, Woodrow Wilson had a lot of Jewish advisors. Who doesn't? Barack Obama is full of Jewish advisors. We've always been very good at being advisors. Let's see, who do we get questions here? Shlomo says, Gershon Bacon writes about this in English, about Aguda and Poland. Yes, Gershon Bacon has a book. It's called, published in 1996, it was his doctoral dissertation about Agudas Yisrael in Poland, talking about the issues of, it's really dealing about Agudas Yisrael in a political sense, the voting patterns, and the internal disputes, you know, with the Poli Agudas Yisrael. The book is very interesting because it talks about, you know, the feuds and how to make a political party work. This was the first time, really. Yisrael says, do I think that early Haredim like this type would be shocked by Haredi culture today? No, not at all. I think that this is a natural development of, when I said that he said it's like a new religion, it's really overstating the case. What it is it's a retreat into a rabbi named Yosef Ashkenazi. He was known as the Tana of Tzfat. He wrote a commentary on the Mishnah. They call him the Tana of Tzfat. He was an extremist. He was attacks the Rambam and all these things. He was way out of, you know, his time. I mean, he was before his time, you could say. But you always had these sorts of reactionary type of sentiment and ideas. You know, every era brings out different things. The Golden Age of Spain is not what we're living in now. But that doesn't mean that, you know, just like the Haredim say that the modern Orthodox are distortion, which isn't true. Because you have the Golden Age of Spain, you have all these great rabbis, even though maybe in Poland you didn't have many people having this approach, it's the same thing today. the Haredi positions and attitudes, yes, it's different than what was 50 years ago, and it's different than what was in the Golden Age of Spain, but you can definitely find sources, and not just sources, you can find great rabbinic figures in the past who had these ideas, but they couldn't be activated in practice because the population wasn't ready for them. The whole idea of Das Torah. Rabbis were speaking about Das Torah even before the 20th century. They didn't use that term, but the people weren't going to listen to it. That's why it never took off. And this is my big disagreement with Gershom Bacon, since Shlomo mentions Bacon. Bacon sees Das Torah as a 20th century phenomenon. I disagree entirely. What's the 20th century phenomenon is that the people were willing to listen because they were more yeshiva educated in a certain type of yeshiva, but in the, you always had rabbis who thought this. So that's why this article, which is an interesting article, I think his name is Yoav Sarek, but he's not a historian. If he was a historian, he would know that this is not a new religion. It's a new manifestation, but as always, Judaism has had plenty of new manifestations, but it's using ideas that were latent. Let's see. And Yishol says, does today's extremism make 30 years ago seem mild? I don't think so. If you read what the Stipler writes in his letters, it is incredibly extreme. The difference, however, is that the Stipler was known to be extreme. We had classes on him, but he was not the dominant, you know, there was a whole Chevron scene, there was others. The Stipler's positions were not regarded as the mainstream Haredi positions for much of the world. Today, it's different. The brother of Steinman is not an extremist at all. You know, the funny thing is, they have all this rhetoric at these rallies, and yet the Haredi leadership, Rav Steinman, has already agreed to compromises. Some people are very cynical. They think the whole point of this rally is to show the masses, the Hamonam, that they've gone all out, and then they can make the compromise. You know, had they not made the compromise without going out and protesting and using all this rhetoric, then it would be problematic. But there's already been, don't you recall, a few weeks, the basic outline of a plan. That's what the great dispute is about. Rabbi Auerbach doesn't believe in this. But Rabbi Steinman's people, unless there's been a change, but everything we know up to now is that they are ready for a compromise, and Rabbi Steinman himself supported Nachal Haredi. So what's then all this business with the protest rallies and everything? Because it can't be seen as if the Haredim lose. They did lose in the election, but they can't be seen as losing. You know, it has to be no one can give up the appearance, so everyone's going to compromise in the end. At least that's what the people in the inner circle say, that Rabbi Steinman's camp knows there has to be a compromise, and but the appearances can't be that Lapid won. Shlomo says how the Moetzes never met and the politicians made the proclamations. Yes, that's this book by the author of, whose name escapes me now, Mikatavitzad Hey-Er. He shows that the Moetzes Gedolei Torah never met. It went years without meeting. And then I spoke about it in previous classes. And then what happened was... since it didn't meet, instead you had great individuals who gave the decisions. Even later, when you have a Degel Torah, you don't need to meet. If Rashach says it, that's enough. So we know the Moetzes never met, and that's a long story, exactly. And you're saying in Poland, it didn't, Yitzhak Breuer speaks about it. But my question on Rav Chaim Ozer is that I don't see how... You know, I think we see today that even individual rabbis could turn into organizations. Avram says, does the trajectory of the Haredi culture frighten you when you look ahead 20 years? I'm actually more optimistic. Because last week we spoke about how the Haredi world was so frightened years ago that if you opened up a rabbinical seminary of Berlin in the land of Israel, the yeshivas would empty out and everyone would want secular education. And we're going to speak about that next week as well. Because Rabbi Katz is one of the leading opponents of it. Today, there's no fear of this. What's the great fear? The fear is that if the students are allowed to go to the army, or even if they don't have to go to the army, if they can go to work without really going to the army, the great fear among the Haredi Rosh Yeshiva is that the yeshivas will empty out. And that will be it for their empire. And some yeshivas will just collapse. Because we know that many Haredim want to work. And they can't work because they have to go to the army. So if you give them some sort of out, national service or something, that is the fear, I believe, of many in the Haredi world, that it will be the end of the yeshivas. And this is not something surprising, as we already saw, that they opposed the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin precisely because they were afraid that it would hurt the yeshivas. I believe, since something has to change, and I think the responsible leaders know that, he talks about this, that sort of life can't go on. So I think the Haredi world will be moderated as soon as they go out to work. They'll be like everyone else. So I'm not really frightened. If you would assume that the Haredi culture of today, and you go ahead 20 years and just add increasing birth rate, of course it's something to be frightened. I wrote about this on the Sfarim blog. A Haredi majority population of the Haredi we have today would mean a totalitarian state. It would mean stop funding of all non-Haredi institutions. It would look like Iran. However, I don't believe that's going to happen. Because I believe that by the natural development, it will become more like the American Haredi world, which is a much more natural way of life. You can't live on charity. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to have the rest of your life, you're going to be supported by taxpayers. I'm actually optimistic at how things are going. And I'm afraid that all this, all this forcing of this matter, maybe from Lapid and the others, this is what's actually causing the reaction. If both sides come at it, with seichel, and adopt the perspective that no one wins, no one loses. And granted, I understand how people on the left don't feel it's fair that, the Haredim, they don't have to go to the army and everything. But at the end of the game, we have to look at the end result and what's the goal. And, the Haredi, it's a different culture. You can't deal with them like you do with other cultures. If the prize at the end is to integrate them into society, then you have to adopt a smarter approach. By the way, that is the goal as well. It's not the army. The Haredim understand this very well. It's not just about the army. It's about integrating Haredim into larger society because the state cannot survive with a poor, uneducated, non-working population of 30, 40, 50%, 25% of first graders today are in the Haredi school system. The country will simply not survive. And truthfully, if Saudi Arabia and these other countries were smart, they would fund these extremist Haredi groups because that would be the end of the state of Israel. But that's not going to happen. And that's why it's important not to make this about winning or losing. But the Haredim understand that it's about integrating them. And for many Haredim, that's fine. And for Rabbi Steinman, I think that's fine as well to a certain extent. But if you don't believe that the Haredim should be integrated at all, then going to the army is just symbolic. So everyone needs to understand that this isn't just about going to the army and doing your share. Majority of Israel has decided that the Haredi society now has to move in and be part of the country. And if the Haredi society wants to lead, as it should want to lead, isn't Torah supposed to lead? Then you have to. Okay. Yisrael says, is it really new that the Haredi leader is not the greatest scholar? Was Rav Shach the greatest scholar in his day? Rav Shach was a great Torah scholar. No one can deny that. A great Talmudist. He was not a posek. But you don't need to be a posek. But Rav Shach was recognized as an outstanding, outstanding Talmud Chacham. The stipler before him, outstanding. The Chazon Ish, obviously outstanding. And Rav Yoshev, not just outstanding, but a great posek. By the way, look in the next Sfarim blog. I'm going to publish something about Rav Yoshev from manuscript, what Rav Herzog writes about him. No one's ever seen it. I found it in an archive. What Rav Herzog says about Rav Yoshev, a young Rav Yoshev, unbelievable. So yes, I don't know of any example where you had Lithuanian Haredi leaders who were not regarded as the leading Torah scholars. Yes, Bill says it's more about education than the army. I wouldn't say education, Bill. I'd say it's more about integration than the army. Integration. And you can see that's a good thing. The non-religious and the religious Zionists, they want the Haredim to be part of society. If they hated them so much and thought that they were just, negative forces, they want to keep them far away, keep them on their reservations. If you want to really solve the Haredi problem, quote unquote, you can create reservations. Some of them even want these reservations, like the Indians have. But they don't want that. How can you run a society like that? They want them to be integrated, and because many non-Haredim, they don't like Haredism as an ideology, and they hate the language used. But on a person-to-person basis, they know them. They're friendly with them in many areas. I'm not talking about places like Beit Shemesh, but I've seen it when I lived there in Jerusalem and other places. Haredim and non-Haredim always could get along with each other. You see them schmoozing and on the streets and cabs, so they can live together. There's no question about it. Yisrael says, pretty shocking is to hear of the hanging of British soldiers. That's the first time you heard this, Yisrael? take a look, read up on the Irgun and what they did. And the Lehi. Lehi was more extreme. And how about throwing bombs into neighborhoods, Arab bus stops? You say it sounds like cold-blooded murder and a violation of the Geneva Accord. Were there ramifications? Did the British retaliate? Sure, the British retaliated. In fact, with the leaders of Lehi, one of the leaders, who was it? Was it Raziel? He was shot on sight without even trial. As soon as they got him, they shot him. And there was the British army. It was like martial law. They read up on some of the what was going on in 46, 47. And not only that, you know, send escorts. This is the British controlled Palestine in 1946. And yet you could not, and 47, 48, and yet you could not bring trucks. Trucks could not come from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem without being attacked by Arabs who were on the mountains over there. The only time they can get through is when once in a blue moon the Arabs would send a military escort. So here the British are supposed to be controlling the country, and the only thing they're controlling is Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The whole way between that, the Arabs are having free-for-alls. What do you think the Haganah was for? Haganah was to protect the Jewish settlements because the British were not doing it, and the British were bending over backwards, basically, to help the Arabs in this. And it's not only because of the oil situation. It's because the local soldiers, of course, they turned against the Jews. Wouldn't you turn against the Jews if the Jews were killing you? By the way, the Arabs also fought against the British. So from 36 to 39, there was a revolt in Palestine. Bill says, without education, integration will be harder than the U.S. Okay, I don't know if it's going to be harder. I mean, you need education, obviously. In Israel, the men in the Haredi school system don't even get basic math knowledge. So, yes, you'll need a core curriculum of sorts, and that's going to be a tough one. But there, too, you could have a compromise. Shas has already agreed to adopt the core, or at least elements of the core curriculum, because I don't see how anyone could make the case that the study of mathematics is against Torah values or anything like that. And finally, this will be the last question. Didn't Steinsaltz resign from the Sanhedrin? Yes, he did resign. I don't know why. I was just shocked that he joined it, because at first it seemed to me like this is some crazy thing. Who can establish a Sanhedrin? Especially, this wasn't the Sanhedrin. It's not like the greatest Torah sages in the land of Israel established the Sanhedrin. This was who I thought at least were kooks. It was a very right-wing organization as well. They came out with a psak halacha that it's forbidden to give back land. They've come out with all sorts of these sorts of piskei din. I didn't know Rabbi Steinsaltz was so right-wing either. If I'm not mistaken, there's a website, or at least there used to be a website about the Sanhedrin, which had all their various proclamations. I haven't heard much about this Sanhedrin recently, so we'll see. In another few weeks, maybe we'll see if they start talking about doing a Karban Pesach. In any event, we've come to the end. I want to thank you all, wish you a good Purim, a happy Purim, and we will pick up next week. Okay, good night, everyone.